Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Couple Speak Relationship Forum on Blog Talk Radio. This program focuses on all kinds of relationship issues, bringing you guest experts who provide inside information and vital tools to help you do better with your partner, spouse, friends, family, and with yourself. I'm your host, Susan Lager, a psychotherapist at the Couple Center in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, where I broadcast live each month on Wednesdays at 8:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Tonight's 45-minute episode, The ABCs of Financial Goal Setting, features my return guest, the very popular Heather Brontës, a financial wizard talking about some things you must know and do to achieve financial stability and success. Heather is a financial advisor with Ameriprise Financial, and she has 19 years of experience and specializes in helping people who are saving for multiple goals, be they college planning, the purchase of a home, or retirement. She helps them manage their financial life and protect their loved ones. Heather also has a subspecialty in working with people around financial issues related to divorce. Heather now lives in Cornelius, North Carolina. She's relocated and can be reached at heather.brontas@ampf.com. Now, one thing, if you're already on the call and would like to ask a question or make a comment, just dial 1 on your phone and you'll be in line to join us on the air. I generally take callers as we go, so don't be shy about joining in at any point. I really like for this to be a fluid experience for listeners. Hi, Heather. Welcome to my show.
Hi, Susan. Thank you.
I'm so glad to have you join me again after your last episode with me. Divorce and money was so wildly popular.
I'm looking forward to this conversation as well. I think, you know, people are nervous about what's going on in the market and different areas of finances, and I'm looking forward to hopefully shedding some light on that.
Good. Hopefully we can demystify some stuff because, you know, there's so much complicated information out there about financial do's and don'ts. I think it just overwhelms people. I know it overwhelms my brain at times. So I would like to boil it down to the essentials that you've learned about in this program, that you learned about what creates stability and success in this arena. And I'm wondering if you could start by telling our listeners just a little bit about the work you do.
So what I do is work with people who are, as you said earlier, planning for multiple goals. How do we get that paycheck to meet all of these needs harmoniously?
Okay. So you help them look at a number of different arenas to look at how they can balance these different needs.
I do, as well as how they can communicate partners so that they can have the most success as they're moving forward.
Yes, very, very important. I see that in my work all the time, what they talk about, how they talk, or whether they collaborate or not. Now, I'm wondering if we could start, Heather, with you giving listeners a very brief overview without triggering people and having them head for the hills, about what's happening in the stock market as it may affect people's planning decisions. I know a lot of people are very nervous with the upcoming election and terrorism and all kinds of things. Could you give people just a kind of background and let them know how you think that's likely to affect things?
Well, although the market has been down the beginning of the year, and that's unusual for us, it's common for that to happen in the market. What goes up must come down, I tell people. And if you're doing planning, most of the goals or things that you're working toward are many years out, so it doesn't matter as much what's going on today. I will tell people that having concerns about the government or being concerned about who's going to be incoming president is not an investment strategy. Presidential election years typically bring out the Go America spirit in all of us. So although it's been hard for us to see the downturn now, we're not envisioning this as a recession like we saw in the late 2007 going forward.
That's great. So the uncertainty about events and upcoming events in the political arena, it sounds like you're saying it may have some immediate kind of up or down, but in terms of the long-range picture, people don't need to worry.
That's correct. I think if you have a plan in place and you stick with that, regardless of what's going on in the market, you will win in the end.
Good. And this all seems to presume, you know, the word plan seems to presume timely, not people scrambling at the last minute to figure out some, you know, how to manage their financial life. And let me ask you one question I may not have thought about in looking at the show ahead of time. Is there a time, an optimal time, when you would say a person or a couple really needs to start getting their financial house in order?
I think as in any sort of planning, the sooner you start, the easier it will be over time. Think about planning for a vacation. If you were to just wake up one morning and decide you wanted to fly to Hawaii, that would be quite a scramble of trying to figure out where you need to go and what time you need to be there and how you're going to organize your luggage. It's the same thing with your finances. It's trying to look ahead and plan slowly over time.
Okay, so it's never too early. If somebody's in their early 20s and they might say, well, I don't have any money, all I'm faced with is college debt, or, you know, I work at a low-level job, it sounds like you're saying it's not too soon to start putting a plan in motion.
Definitely, because if you can start just a little bit each week now, you'll be far better off in the long run.
Okay. I wish people had talked to us about this when we were in our 20s. You know, we were interested in sex, drugs, and rock and roll. Nobody was thinking about this kind of stuff.
That's so right. The future, what was that?
Right. Now, originally we were talking about naming this the four cornerstones of a person's financial life, and I think it felt a little bit too much of a yawn for people, too much, you know, it might not be a draw. But that, I'm wondering if you could say something about what you see, a kind of overview as what you see as the four cornerstones of a person's financial life, the pillars, so to speak.
So through financial planning, we look at four areas: the cash and liabilities, so think about the money that you earn, and how do you manage your debt. We look at protection issues, kind of the what if this happens? What's my plan A, B, C, and D? We look at taxes. I know not everybody's favorite subject, but we need to manage that now and in the future. And we also look at investments. It's not enough to be setting money aside. We need to make sure we're setting it aside in the right way, in the right investments.
Okay, so to be mindful about these four different arenas and to somehow be paying attention to all of them in a very intentional way. I'm wondering if we could start with the cash and liabilities. Could you say a little more about that? I mean, you know, it's obviously involves savings and checking accounts, but if we could start with savings. You know, one of the first questions as I was thinking about this program that came to mind was savings. That's great. But where should people put savings? Under the mat? They used to put it under the mattress. That seemed fine. And I have heard that it's not very, you know, there's not a big return on your investment if you open up savings accounts. How much and where would you advise people to put savings? Let's say a couple is in their mid-20s. Okay?
Okay. Well, I think the foundation of any savings is just that, your bank savings account. And no, we're not setting the world on fire with the interest rates right now. But I often will say, when your bank statement comes in, I swear your mailbox talks to your dishwasher, your car, and your furnace. And if that statement has gone up since the last month, well, then one by one, they all start saying, I need it, I need it. So you need that rainy day money, and the savings account is the perfect place for it because you're not going to be penalized for putting the money in or pulling it out too soon.
Okay. You know, one of the things I did a few years ago, you know, I'm self-employed, and I always had, I was a C corporation, and I had to pay payroll taxes and like all other self-employed people, quarterly payments. And I would hear clients all the time bemoaning the fact that they couldn't make their quarterly payments and they had nothing left for April. And so by negative example, I learned, you know what, I don't think I'm going to make that mistake. So I opened up a tax savings account into which each week I would put a chunk of my earnings so that it wouldn't be scrambling at the end of the quarter, and especially scrambling in April. And I cannot tell you, even though at times it's been hard because there have been slow weeks, I have never regretted having that. Even if, let's say, major appliances all go down at once and I might have to draw from that to pay for that, it's a net. It's a really, psychologically, it's an important net. And it's nice to know that you're preparing for eventualities.
Yes, there's nothing more alarming than having a bill come up and you don't know how you're going to pay for it. So this just puts you at ease.
Okay, so that's one important thing for people not to fall prey to the notion that because it's a very low rate of interest on a savings account that it's useless.
Correct, because this isn't your long-term money. This is your emergency fund money, your rainy day money.
Okay, okay. And how much would you say, ideally, in an ideal world, what would people have set aside? I've heard things like a year of income, 6 months, and I know very few people. I think I only know one couple where they have a year of, they have 6 months of expenses fully tucked away in savings. What would be ideal to work for?
I talk to couples if there is a single income household, I like to see 6 months worth of expenses. So not 6 months worth of income, 6 months of expenses. And if it's a dual income household, I think 3 months is satisfactory in having your extra money. And this gets built up over time because that can still be a significant amount of money and can be overwhelming to think you have to save that much. But put every extra penny in that account.
Okay. Okay. So you have a little bit more of a net when you have a dual income household. So that would only be 3 months. That's good to know. Now, That brings up another question. Under the cash and liabilities cornerstone, managing that, we talked about how one of the things is debt. And I'm wondering if you could say something to our listeners about debt, a word of advice about how to use it, that it doesn't necessarily mean it's a dirty word, et cetera.
Yes, love it or hate it, debt's part of most of our lives. And I really wanted to stress during this call that debt is not all bad. In today's low interest rate environment, it's often the best way to make your purchases. And I typically will use a benchmark of 5%. If it's going to cost more than 5%, then work harder to pay it down quicker. And if not, then borrow more and spend less of your cash. Because on average, an investment long-term is going to earn greater than that 5%, and that's where I...
When you say 5%, you mean it's got to be 5% interest or less?
Yes.
Okay. That's pretty low. I mean, there are cards out there at 5% interest? now?
There aren't cards, but I see people who are paying cash for vehicles when they could get a 0 or 2% interest rate loan.
Yeah.
People who are trying to pay houses down quickly when they're only paying 4% interest rate on that loan.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And I would take it that if people can make use of, let's say they've gotten into some debt higher than they're comfortable with at higher interest rates, it makes sense to consolidate it with a 0% transfer if you're really obedient and you pay it off within the time frame.
And that's the key right there, is getting it paid off in the time frame, because if you don't, some companies will retroactively charge you that higher rate of interest on the entire balance.
Right. I had that happen once with Home Depot. I thought I was being really smart. And I don't know, I think I did one of those 2-year 0%. We had to buy some massive thing unexpectedly, and I figured, we'll just do the 0%. And I wasn't really diligent about when it was due. And next thing I knew was, I don't know, I think it was like $345 in interest. It was massive. And I said to myself, well, lesson learned. And, you know, from now on, if I ever do anything like that, I will put myself on a promotional, I call it my promo plan. Like, what was the promotion? What do I have to pay back each month by when in order not to incur those accrued interest.
And that's an excellent strategy, so you aren't surprised at the end, like your tax payment, because you've prepared all along.
Yes. So planning, and being very conscious and deliberate. Now, when you talk about cash and liabilities, one of the things that comes up in my work with couples all the time is, you know, how they manage household finances together, either collaboratively or unilaterally. And I will often see couples polarizing around what's worth spending on. Oh, let's get it. No, let's not. That's a want. That's not a need. And where couples take roles, and they are definitely not working together. And I'm wondering if you could say something about what, in your experience, looks like the best kind of collaboration around managing household finances?
Well, one of the areas I value most about the work you do, Susan, is you're providing a place for each person to discuss how roles impact their relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's important for people to talk about together what the goals are and why that goal is important to them. Because they do need to work together to be successful together.
Yeah. But the problem is often people have very different tolerance levels for risk, or a very different sense of what's worth what. Or conversely, I've worked with couples where they're so much on the same page. No, there's no good cop, bad cop. Nobody puts the brakes on, so together they collude to way overspend, and no one is saying, whoa, slow down, we're getting a little out of control here. We're thinking only about our wants, not our needs. So,
and more often than not, I'll see where you have one person is very conservative and one can be more free with the money, let's say. And it all comes back to that plan. It's working with a professional and identifying together what your goals are. I mean, the beauty of the work I do is it's all just the facts. It's, when do you need the money? How much are you going to need? Okay, so like the credit card example, we know we need to set aside this much each month to meet that goal. And if it's important to both of them, or they're willing to compromise on, this is important to me, so I'll give you this, then they can successfully work together. But sometimes it does require a third party.
I would think that that would be very, when it comes to the actual dollar amounts, I would think it would be very useful for couples to have a third uninvested party, somebody who has no investment in going this way or the other, a dispassionate party saying, you know, given your picture, and, you know, that you may want a boat and you want a hot tub and you want vacations, but you also, it sounds like, would like to retire before you're 110, I would see you as needing to do this, this, and this. So you become the voice of, I would imagine, where you give them permission to spend, what would be slush fund money, and where you give them, where you let them know they need to put the brakes on?
Yes, and that's perfect wording, because we need to make sure we're building fund money in there so that everybody's happy. But I always chuckle when I will have a couple come to me and say, we talked about this and we asked ourselves, what would Heather think? So it makes me happy that they're listening and that they are recognizing making that plan will work best for them.
Yeah. You know, one thing I do with couples that's often very helpful, and I let them know, I say, you know, obviously I'm no financial advisor, but in partnerships, you want a balance of collaboration and unity and individuality, independence. You, if it's too skewed in any one direction, it's really not great. So it's probably important for the two of you to decide what are the household expenses and the major things like savings and investments, et cetera, where, you know, let's assume that they both work. They both earn money. They may not earn the same amount, and that's unusual that couples do. But it probably would be useful on the collaborative end of things for you to decide on the front end what proportion of your incomes you would like to contribute to those things that you see as needs, investments, taxes, all that other thing. And so that involves collaboration and coming to agreement and consensus, but that you also on the front end decide what proportion of your weekly income would you like to allocate as fund money, slush funds, individual slush funds, which you don't have to answer to each other around. So if you, John, want to get golf clubs with yours over time, and if you, Mary, want to get, you know, go to TJ Maxx and buy a lot of clothing, I don't mean to be sexist here, but it often looks this way, you do not have, nobody's evaluating the other one's choices about where to spend. So they're kind of combining a we fund with we things, we decisions, and slush funds, where they don't have a say over. The only say is they agree on the front end what amount, what dollar amount to put into it each week. What do you think of that?
It gives them freedom. Yeah, it really gives them the freedom to spend guilt-free.
Yeah. Yeah, it seems to have that effect. It seems to. Now, are you likely to tell people, given your financial picture, I would see you as having X dollars available for fun stuff? Or wants, not needs?
Yes. That's a big part is looking at that budget, because very few of us keep track of where our money's going. And once we have that figure and there's some flexibility, then we can break it out and say, okay, this needs to be saved, and this can be money that you can go out to dinner or to the movies or to a concert.
Right. So it's really being very intentional. Sounds like that's kind of one of the, should be a cornerstone as well. Being intentional about this whole thing, not seeing it as helter-skelter or impulsive or driven by some immediate situation, but being intentional about your vision and creating an action plan around that.
Yes, and it gives you the peace of mind to do the spending that you know you're doing within your limits.
Yeah, that's great. Now, I'm wondering if you could say something about the next cornerstone of a person's financial life. You talked in our conversation about protection, insurance, et cetera. If you could say a little bit about that.
I think the important piece in the protection arena is, what is our plan B, C, and D in case things don't go as we anticipated, in case we don't work as long as we had hoped? if we're unable to work due to an illness or if someone passes away and that impact on losing that income or their emotional support, how do we protect for that? And then the other piece is the estate plan, which is having something in place, who's going to care for your children, who's going to inherit the items that you've gone out and bought with your fund money or your savings, and how do you plan for these? And just understanding that, especially from an insurance perspective, people often think they need life insurance just when their children are little, but there are tax strategies, there are estate planning strategies. There is often a need for that longer. And there's also disability income protection. Oftentimes people will have that through work, but it very seldom is enough.
Okay.
Just making sure that you have adequate means to protect your family.
Okay. Do you recommend to people long-term care insurance? Because I hear very mixed reviews about that.
I do, and I used to speak with people in their mid and late 50s. I now, that's how people celebrate their 40th birthday with me. I give them a call and say, hey, we need to talk about this. It's in
okay.
a very costly costly need, and we need to protect for it.
Is there a point in time when you would say it just doesn't pay, that someone's better off just becoming, impoverished and dumbing down all their assets and then going on to Medicaid? A point at which, let's say somebody's in their 60s. I work with a lot of couples in their 60s, and many of them aren't prepared for much of anything. They had some crisis or crises. Is it too late then for them to purchase long-term care insurance?
No, you can purchase long-term care into your 70s, but there certainly is a point. You want to make sure that if they're going to qualify for Medicaid, then it doesn't make sense for them to spend the money in premiums going along. And what I most often see is that the first spouse needs some level of care. And let me just qualify that by saying that most of long-term care or extended care needs are provided in the people's homes. That's where most of the claims are paid. But that
okay.
first spouse who becomes ill spends down the assets, so we need to protect that the other spouse, the healthy spouse.
Okay. Okay, so unless a couple would qualify, they're close in income to a Medicaid level, it sounds like even though it may be very expensive, it would pay to look into long-term care insurance, even if they're in their 60s.
Yes, because across the country, the average care cost for this level of care can be $9,000 a month, and that doesn't include doctor's visits, clothing, visits to the beauty salon. It's very, very expensive. So the premium,
yeah, a lot.
As is the case with most insurance, is much lower.
Yeah. Okay. Now, moving along, can you say something about the third pillar? You had identified in your presentation to me investments, and investments as a third major area to be mindful about. Can you say something about that?
Yes, and it goes back once again to that plan. Having a well-thought-out strategy for investing is critical, but equally important is sticking to that plan. So when we have times like now, when we are concerned about the market, we kind of put our blinders on and say, this is not money I need today. This is money I need in 10, 15, maybe 20 years. So sticking with that plan.
Okay. Now, what about people, can you say something about covering college costs? Because that's such a huge source of anxiety for people. I work with a number of somewhat older parents. They're maybe in their late 50s when their kids are college age, so they started a little late, and they're freaking out because they don't have $200,000 laying around. So what would your recommendations be for people who don't have extra savings sitting around for this? And also, I guess, what to expect of their children in the process?
this is the one area where people seem to hesitate the longest in beginning their savings for. There are a number of strategies either through 529 investments or through insurance or various other investment vehicles to save. But I will often encourage parents to look at student loans because this will help build the child's credit, because really no credit is worse than bad credit. It gives you an extra 4, maybe 5 years to save. And then you, if the child pleases you and does well, then you pay back that loan.
If not, the kid's screwed, right?
If not, the debt's in their name, so.
Right. Okay. So they're building credit by student loans.
Yes, and that will help them when they go to buy cars, buy homes, and begin with their financial livelihood.
You know, that's built into a number of colleges where if the parents qualify, I've seen this, the parents qualify for a Parent Plus loan that would term out their whatever portion they finance over years, it's also expected, it's kind of a built-in, that the kid gets Stafford and Perkin loans, that the kid, you know, I think it's like something like up to $5,000 a year, and that the kid do some work study. I've seen this built into different, I don't know about public colleges or community colleges, but in private colleges, they don't want to create entitlement or a free ride for the kid. So that's just kind of institutionalized.
It is, and I've seen it done a number of ways where typically a couple will say, we can afford this much a year. So you go to whichever school you want, but this is what we're going to contribute. And that's a really smart way around that whole goal planning. With my own daughter, I said, if you get A's and B's, I will pay for the class. If you get a C, I'll pay 70%, and I'm not paying for anything lower than that. So that was
good,
the motivation
you.
Of you better do well.
So it's not just free money falling out of the sky. You have to work for it. You have to show an investment, a time and work investment.
Yes, and I would encourage the parents to seek companies that assist with negotiating financial aid.
Okay, and what would those companies be called for anybody on the line?
I would Google college planning services.
Okay.
And then I will, you know, ask at the school, because they typically have worked with these people as seniors and juniors are looking into the process, because you also want to make sure that it's a reputable company that you're working with. But they
okay.
can do amazing things.
Okay. I know one of the things that was very helpful to us, because we were very anxious about this, you know, not many people have like at least $200,000 just sitting around for college, especially if anything happened in their life that was critical. And one of the things that was very helpful to us was to go to a seminar about demystifying the facts versus the fantasies about school, and that, for instance, state schools might not necessarily be cheaper if you have a stellar kid who does really well and is eligible for major scholarships and goes to might get accepted at a school that has a very good endowment. Stuff like that.
Yes, and often those Ivy League or private schools will compete against one another. So that's how you can kind of drive down those costs even further.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so to be a savvy consumer, you're saying?
Yes.
Yeah. Now, when you talked about, you talk about retirement planning. Do you want to say anything about that? Because that usually is like nails on a chalkboard to people if they haven't begun early enough, or if a lot of life nasty things have happened to them, there are a lot of crises, they've lost businesses. You know, I work with a lot of these couples where somebody just decimated the couple with some of their bad judgments or failed businesses, and they're starting all over again in their 50s. Can you say something about retirement planning?
Yes, first of all, they're not alone. The average 50-year-old has about $15,000 saved for retirement.
Really?
When they leave one job, they will cash out their 401k, either through a need or a want. You mentioned at the beginning of the call the work that I do in divorce financial planning. So we're going from a we to a me. So I think that you just need to say, okay, maybe this means that I'm going to be working part-time in retirement. And I can tell you, with all the years I've been working with people, I can count on one hand the number of clients who have retired and not worked again, some because they needed to and some because they wanted to. Think about how long we're living, and we're living healthy. So I don't think that there's a drop-dead retirement date, so to speak, where you just stop doing it. And at that point, you really just need to earn enough to cover what either your pension, your savings, or your Social Security isn't covering.
Okay. But you're saying the average 50-year-old you've worked with only has about $15,000 in savings?
Not the average 50-year-old that I've worked with, just as a general consensus of the U.S. population.
Okay, that's good to know, because I know I work with a lot of people who have such shame and anxiety about this. They feel like such failures because everything they see on TV is all about savvy retirement planning, and they feel like, well, I have, you know, peanuts. Life kind of bit me, and I have just peanuts. What's wrong with me? So it sounds partly like what you're saying is don't be fooled. And don't be fooled by the notion of retirement as this magical date in time when you're 65 and all income necessarily stops. It's likely you will continue to work in some capacity, even part-time, to augment what you get in you know, like Social Security or pension or whatever.
Yes, and from my perspective, nothing's more frustrating when I hear people tell others that you need to have, I don't know, $1 million to retire. Unless you know the person's situation, very few clients that I work with have $1 million at retirement, and they retire
right.
Successfully.
Yeah. Same, you know, same with people I work with. Again, it creates this impossible bar for people to meet. Now, moving on, can you say something about the fourth pillar, taxes? And, you know, I know in reading your presentation, you talked about the balance of being mindful about the balance of taxes today versus taxes tomorrow. So I'm wondering if you could talk about, you know, the different categories of tax-deferred, taxable, and tax-free, just briefly.
Certainly. So
what the differences are, so people know about that.
Yes. And in the taxable category are things like your bank savings account or checking account, maybe mutual fund or stocks that you have outside of a retirement plan, where you pay taxes on the contribution, so the money that you're adding to the account, if it grows in value. So if you're lucky enough to earn interest on that savings account, you'll get a tax form at the end of the year to pay taxes on that difference. And then if you have an investment that grows in value, that growth is taxed at the sale of it. So I paid $500, it's now worth $600, I have to pay taxes on that other $100.
Okay. That would be tax deferred, right?
That is actually the taxable, because you get taxed each year. Each year you get a 1099 on any dividends or interest that you earned. The most popular category is the tax deferred. That's our 401k or 403b, a retirement plan set up through work that allows you to just draw money before taxes and deposited into an investment. It grows over the years, and then at retirement, you would withdraw that, but every penny is taxable at that time. I refer to that as the government savings bond, because some of you may not have heard of required minimum distributions, but at 70 and a half, because the IRS loves their half birthdays, you're actually required to take money out of those accounts whether or not you need it so that they can start collecting the taxes. The final category is the tax-free. It's misleading in the sense that the money you contribute, you're paying taxes. You don't get that annual tax bill. And if it's structured properly, you can actually withdraw it without paying taxes. So this would be Roth IRAs, specially designed life insurance, which is why I'll often use life insurance for college planning, because it's a way to pay those bills, possibly without paying taxes on it. So you were talking about the balance earlier, and there's a myth that when you're in retirement, you're in a lower tax bracket. And you may be for a bit, but let's say tax brackets never went up. Sheer inflation is going to drive us into a higher tax bracket in retirement.
Mm-hmm.
So we always need to make sure we're managing that so that in retirement, when you go to buy a car, you don't say, oh, Heather, I don't need $25,000. I really need to withdraw $30,000 because I need to send the IRS their piece.
Okay. Okay, so just being aware of the differences. Now, what would you say to, I work with a lot of self-employed people who, you know, they don't have a company contributing to a 401k. What would you recommend for them if they're like in their 50s and they wanted to put money away that, you know, as much as possible of it is protected as much as possible from taxes? Which one of these things would you advise?
The benefit for self-employed is they can actually establish their own retirement plan. So there are 401ks, even for people who have they are the owner and sole employee. It's called a mini-K. That is a means for them to save money on a tax-deferred basis. But I like life insurance as a retirement savings vehicle. I think in the long run, the tax benefits are better, but we would have to look at what their income is in any given year and
Whole life insurance or term?
Neither. There are actually policies called variable life insurance or indexed life insurance that allow some growth as well as cash value in the plans. Term insurance does not have any cash value. It is pure death benefit.
Right.
So when you pass, there's money going to your to protect your loved ones.
Right. Okay. Well, you know, there are a lot of choices, and I'm sure for a lot of people, you know, it just feels like grief. But, you know, obviously, luckily, there are people like you to help walk laymen and civilians through this. So I would like to thank, we're going to have to wrap up, unfortunately, Heather, believe it or not, we're out of time. I would like to thank our listeners and thank you, Heather, for being such a wealth of information, albeit, you know, a little anxiety-provoking, I have to admit, because there's always the sense of, am I doing enough? Am I doing the right thing? It's really been an informative show. I know I've learned a lot. I hope other people have. Now, people can reach you, Heather, let me make sure I get this right, at Ameriprise Financial at Heather, H-E-A-T-H-E-R dot A dot B-R-O-U-N-T-A-S at A-M-P-F dot com. Or where would they call you if they wanted to work with you directly and just give you a call?
So that they could call me at 704-892-7575.
Okay.
I'm not licensed in every state, so if they had questions, I could certainly refer them to someone who could help them. They're also welcome to visit my LinkedIn page, and that will give them more information.
Okay. Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate your input on the show, and I wouldn't be surprised if people contacted you. So my next show, thank you again, Heather. I really appreciate it, and hopefully we can do another one of these soon. My next show will be on Wednesday, March 16th, and the subject will be announced. It's unlikely I will be having a guest, as I'll be leaving for vacation the week after that. But good night to all of you, and enjoy the rest of this faux winter, and mind your money. Take care. Bye-bye.